Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the harsh sentencing on trumped-up charges of three Al Jazeera journalists in Egypt who were arrested for essentially doing their jobs. An expert on the Arab media and politics, Marwan Crady, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss the international media's reaction to the Egyptian military's kangaroo court's verdict that came down one day after Secretary of State John Kerry met with Egypt's new leader, General Sisi, who apparently ignored Kerry's pleas on behalf of freedom of the press, but nevertheless was promised a reward of $1.3 billion in military aid from the U.S. taxpayer. Then we will speak with Andrew Michta, a professor of international relations at Rhodes College and author of several books on European security and transatlantic relations, the latest of which is The Limits of Alliance, the United States, NATO, and the EU in North and Central Europe, about the erupting political scandal in Poland following the publication of secretly recorded private conversations among top politicians. We will discuss who might have recorded the candid, alcohol-fueled conversations that disparage U.S.-Polish relations and examine recent charges from the former Danish Prime Minister and head of NATO that the Russian intelligence services are covertly funding European environmental NGOs who are protesting fracking for natural gas. Then finally, we'll look into Pope Francis's health and the extent that his recent remarks in Calabria excommunicating members of the mafia might put a target on his back from a criminal gang whose annual revenues are $75 billion, or 3.5% of Italy's GDP. Paul Vallelli, a professor of public ethics and media at the University of Chester in the UK and author of Pope Francis, Untying the Knots, joins us to discuss the bold and apparently fearless new pope who is making dangerous enemies as he fights corruption and tries to reform the Vatican. And joining us now is Marwan Crady, who is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Crady.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And the sentencing of three Al Jazeera journalists in Egypt, of course, has created a storm of protest around the world, particularly in terms of organizations protecting journalists. And I take it that John Kerry, who was just in Cairo a day before this sentence was handed down, clearly by Sisi, the new leader, or at least with his collusion, was unable to convince Sisi that this was a bad idea?
I guess so. I mean, we don't even know for sure that the U.S. is very interested at this point in promoting press freedom, media freedom, or democracy in the region. I think people in the Obama administration feel they have bigger fish to fry with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, with the Ukraine, things of that sort. But it was definitely a bad idea. And what's remarkable to me is that the story of the three Al Jazeera staff has become a sort of a global scandal. But there have been multiple stories over the last month or so about the shrinking margin of media freedom in Egypt that have received far less attention. And I'm one example is the end of the satirical comedian's Bassem Youssef's show. This is a show that thrived under the Muslim Brotherhood, and even though that government at that time tried to sue Mr. Youssef, it failed or didn't try hard enough to shut him down. The show was suspended during the election, the latest presidential election. By the time Mr. Sisi was president, it was announced that the show would be canceled. There was the verdict, the 15-year sentence that was handed in absentia against the activist and blogger Ala Abdel Fattah. This has to do with the protest law. In Egypt today, you cannot protest. The police has the right to arrest you if you don't have a permission from the government to have a protest or a demonstration. There were the death sentences to dozens of Muslim Brotherhood members and sympathizers. There have been harassment of various journalists. The situation of the media in Egypt today is worse than it was in the last year of Mubarak's rule.
So John Kerry, instead of managing to convince Sisi, not to sentence these journalists on these trumped up charges for essentially putting them in jail for doing their job as journalists, instead resumed the $1.3 billion a year aid package to the Egyptian military.
Yes, that's what happened indeed. And of course, Egyptian activists online are very angry at this, but I don't think many people had any illusion that John Kerry was going to change the status of the media in Egypt today.
And you mentioned the cancellation of the Egyptian satirist show. He's always been referred to as Egypt's John Stewart. In fact, 60 Minutes did a profile on him. What is the response throughout the Arab world, given Al Jazeera's got a pretty big footprint and its rivals do as well? How is this being described, the sentencing of Mohamed Fahmy, who's a Canadian citizen of Egyptian descent, and then you've got Peter Gresky, an Australian, previously worked for the BBC, among the three that were sentenced to 7 years in jail for basically doing run-of-the-mill news stories. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary.
Absolutely. I mean, the best way to understand the context for this is to realize that now the Muslim Brotherhood is being treated as a dangerous armed terrorist sect, whether it, by the government of Egypt, but also by Gulf governments like Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Now, for a variety of reasons, Al Jazeera is associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and so Al Jazeera is getting a very rough treatment because of this. If you look at the media in the Arab world today, yes, there are those who are arguing that this is a bad sign. But also, if you look at most Saudi media, they tend to be very supportive of Sisi. They are reporting the story, but they're reporting it as a matter of fact. They're saying, okay, so Egypt sentenced the three Al Jazeera reporters to 7 years. I think two of them were for seven, one for 10. But you don't have the outrage that you see in other parts, in small islands in the Arab world that are not owned or dominated by Gulf media interests, or that you see in a lot of Western media.
Well, the journalists, again, particularly the Australian journalist who working for Al Jazeera, who had previously worked for the CNN, he had just arrived in the country. And the other journalist had worked for the Japanese news organization, Asahi Shimbun. And, of course, the Egyptian-born journalist pointed out in his court case that, look, I drink alcohol. I'm a liberal. I'm not a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. Obviously, the court case, was a farce, right? I mean, it sounds like the judiciary is just rubber stamping what the military and what Sisi wants.
That's what seems to be happening. You know, it does not matter that one of the journalists sentenced as a Canadian. There was also two British. I mean, there's a Dutch journalist. I mean, I think the point does not matter. The fact that these people have dual citizenship, are citizens of Western countries, is not the point. The point is that they're associated with Al Jazeera, that they covered the news in a way that the current rulers of Egypt thought was detrimental to their agenda, and they're paying the price. I think they're being used to send a signal that there's zero tolerance, that, you either report the narrative as we want it. If you report the rival narrative, you're going to get in trouble. It's as simple as that.
Again, I'm speaking with Marwan Kredi, who's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. So the fact that Al Jazeera and its owner, the Emir of Qatar, he's pretty much the odd man out, isn't he, amongst the Saudis and the Gulf because of his support of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the internal politics of the Gulf region, these guys, these journalists are just collateral damage?
I believe so. I believe they're collateral damage. I believe they're part of a campaign. I think the Egyptian government sees this as part of its campaign to take full control of Egypt. to completely dismember Muslim Brotherhood rule in Egypt. And so in many ways, they see this as a domestic issue. I mean, we heard all kinds of stories about Western governments having contacted Mr. Sisi personally. I think the Australian Prime Minister spoke with Sisi over the weekend, and some news stories say that he was encouraged by the conversation. I mean, there could be something going on that eventually Mr. Sisi will issue pardons and look very good to these journalists. But for now, it just seems that the space for media is shrinking more and more, and the government does not seem to really care whether, you know, they will anger the Australian government, the British government, the Canadian government, or the U.S. government.
And the Dutch government. They're holding it.
And the Dutch government.
Dutch reporter as well. So it does seem that it's kind of counterintuitive to go after the press, whether it's in domestic politics or in international politics. And it's even worse to put members of the press in jail on trumped-up charges. You're not exactly inviting good coverage in the press, are you? I mean, there's still, in spite of the control of our press by so many oligarchs, there's still a certain amount of solidarity amongst journalists around the world, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. But I don't think Mr. Sisi really cares. I think the only government that Mr. Sisi would not want to anger right now is the Saudi government. The Saudi government is the main supporter of his regime, is the main political, economic supporter of Egypt right now. And everybody else really doesn't have the same kind of leverage. Even the United States does not have the kind of leverage that it used to have, despite the enormous military aid that comes into Egypt. I don't think the administration feels they can really shake the stick at Sisi with that, because they also don't want to risk losing Egypt completely.
And has the Egyptian press pretty much come under the thumb of the military? I mean, it's the fact that they've gotten rid of Egypt's John Stewart, who was a satirist, although arguably, as many people have argued, John Stewart has become the source of a lot of news for a whole generation of news consumers, simply because they don't either trust or believe in the mainstream media.
Absolutely. I mean, Mr. Bassem Youssef, who's actually a medical doctor, did what late-night comedy does best, which is to expose the hypocrisy of political speech and to make fun of politicians. And that is really political knowledge. That imparts political knowledge, which is why I think he was deemed to be dangerous. There were all kinds of stories about, officials in Saudi Arabia personally intervening. I don't think that was really the case. I think he was embarrassing. I think if you cannot tolerate Al Jazeera doing reports that don't fit your narrative, how are you going to tolerate a guy who has a huge audience making fun of you on a weekly basis? That was not going to work very well. Bassem Youssef's job is a lot more difficult than John Stewart's job. He's working, or he was working, in the kind of environment where the Muslim Brotherhood harassed him. Legally, he was, he had to appear in court multiple times, but he did survive it. I mean, this is the funny thing, that what some people are saying today with some justification is that, in fact, Islamist rule was better for media freedom than military rule has been. Journalists in general in Egypt, yes, the old habits seem to be returning very fast. If you read Al-Ahram, it's the official platform for the government. It's always leading with Sisi's news, who the president met, what the president's agenda is, the president on his bike, the president meeting the Saudi king at the Cairo airport in the Saudi king's private plane, things of that sort. Other media have a bit more margin, but even the independent outlets, when you read them, you can feel a creeping self-censorship coming back. And that's really unfortunate.
Well, Marwan Khairy, just in the broader context, according to Reporters Without Borders, there are 167 journalists imprisoned around the world, and China has the largest number. That's with 32. Eritrea comes in second with 28, and Syria has 16 journalists. Of course, being in a prison in Syria, in one of Assad's prisons, that's a fate worse than death. I spoke with a refugee Syrian doctor recently. Her class was rounded up. All of her fellow doctors were rounded up for early in the piece for treating the wounded demonstrators in the streets who were shot down by the regime. And apparently what the Assad regime does to its prisoners is on the way out, it injects them with either hepatitis or AIDS.
Oh, wow. I have not heard this.
Yeah. Well, this is what this medical doctor told me, that had happened to her colleagues. So it's a pretty, you know, grim world out there. But we're, you know, ostensibly, we're not at war with Syria, but we're certainly not, we're supposedly helping those people who are at war with him, his own people, as it happens. But Egypt is supposed to be not an ally, but a friend. I mean,
yes.
we give them an awful lot of money every year. don't you see this as being a little surreal? We're not getting our money's worth here, are we?
I mean, it is a bit surreal. And I know some thoughtful Egyptians now are willing to give Sisi a chance. They felt at least, you know, get out of the kind of the turmoil, the chronic instability, the crime. So they're looking at a kind of a law and order figure, like a strongman figure. I think that's a problem, though, because I think instead of the rule of law that was central to the aspirations of the revolutionaries in Egypt and Tunisia, we're seeing the rule of force coming back. And the rule of force, the kind of arbitrary power of the government coming back. And Egypt, especially, after all the progress that Egypt has made, the demands for freedom, the kind of unleashing of creativity, of expression during the revolution, you see what I really would like to call the rule of force coming back. I mean, we saw that in the sexual harassment, rape case on the day of Sisi's inauguration. We're seeing it in the way that the protest law is being used to clamp down on any kind of demonstration. We're seeing it in the extremely harsh verdicts that really raise questions about the Egyptian judiciary. We're seeing it in some very strange, you know, there was a column a few days ago in an Egyptian newspaper where the columnist called for shooting street children. Street children are a nuisance, let's kill them. Now, this did trigger an uproar in Egypt, but basically, if you have the power, you do what you want, is a mentality that seems to be creeping back into Egyptian public discourse, and I think that's very dangerous.
And of course, it was, after all, a great news story, the Tahrir Square uprising, bringing the press around the world. It was a moment where everybody had that feel-good moment. What's your, just in closing, Marwan Crady, given this press censorship, is it likely that the press will be able to hold Sisi's feet to the fire? I mean, I think just as in terms of a geopolitical analysis, it seems to me that Sisi and the Saudis, simply their position cannot be sustained over the long term.
That's what I believe. I mean, at some point there will be serious overreach and it will trigger a very strong reaction. But, you know, for the time being, it definitely looks like the press has been intimidated. The sweet taste of the revolution seems to have become kind of the bitter taste of renewed repression. And people were joking on Twitter yesterday that basically instead of the sense of freedom and revolution, the best that Arab can come to now is enjoy Algeria's win in the World Cup. We're moving from a sense of true political agency, a real sense that Arabs are citizens, they're changing their political circumstances, they're changing the world they live in, to the best you can do is enjoy a football game on television. And I think that's really depressing.
Well, Marwan Crady, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about who might have taped the candid alcohol-fueled conversations among top Polish politicians.
I
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Michter, who is a professor of international studies at Rhodes College and the author of several books on European security and transatlantic relations, including his most recent, The Limits of Alliance, the United States, NATO, and the EU in North and Central Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Michter.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you're quoted in the New York Times on Monday in the story of this political scandal that's erupted in Poland, asking about the origins of the tapes that are in question here. Caught on tape is the foreign minister of Poland in conversation with the former finance minister, where the foreign minister is basically complaining about the relationship with the United States and more or less talking about saying it's worth nothing, and more or less talking about the relationship between the United States and Poland as using the analogy of the activities that Monica Lewinsky was involved with in the White House. So obviously on radio here, we have to be careful about what we say. And also he went on to say that what's even more harmful, this is the foreign minister speaking, is it gives Poland a false sense of security vis-a-vis this relationship with the U.S. This is obviously incredibly damaging to U.S.-Polish relations. Your concern is the origins of the tape, I take it.
Yes, and as I said, you know, I don't even want to get into discussing what transpired in private conversations that were illegally taped and language that politicians use that quite often they wouldn't use in any other formal setting. So let's just set this aside. My concern is why these tapes have been released just now. And the reason I say that, we have indication that these tapings have been going on for over a year now, and they've targeted a number of restaurants in Poland that were frequented by the Polish policy elite. So this is not a random disgruntled waiter, in my view, taking an iPhone and trying to record something. But to me, it looks very much like a well-planned and targeted operation to get as much information about the people who are in the position of power. My question is, who has crafted this kind of operation, and why has have those tapes been released right now? And the reason I say this is we have a very dramatically shifting security landscape in Central Europe. As you know, we have the ongoing de facto Russia-Ukraine military conflict. We've had the redrawing of the map in Eastern Europe with the loss of Crimea to Russia. And Poland has taken a very strong position and a lead on the EU policy and NATO policy on the Ukrainian crisis. I simply am mystified and very, very concerned about why these tapes, which are clearly destabilizing the Polish government, undercutting its credibility, as you have indicated, why these tapes are being leaked right now to a major Polish weekly. And I'm very curious as to what steps that newspaper, that magazine, has taken to actually vet them and ascertain the bona fides of the people that they deal with. This is just, to me, something going further beyond any sort of conversation of internal impropriety of a number of government officials. I just don't like the smell of it.
Well, the newspaper, the news magazine, I guess it's the equivalent of Time magazine, Prost, is that how you pronounce it?
Prost, yes.
Prost. It, of course, all it said about the origins of the tapes, and by the way, the full transcripts of these recordings apparently are being released by this news magazine on Monday, and what they've released so far is pretty damaging, so there's obviously more to come. All they've said about the origins of the tape is that they came from a businessman, which, of course, is a very vague term. But the government can't get off the hook because they not only are these tapes damaging, their response by raiding the offices of this publication and clumsily doing so, and it all being broadcast live on Polish television, has done nothing but backfire, surely.
And what you see is, I think, the most damaging aspect of the whole process, in my view, which is that the government does not seem to know the extent to which a number of their ministers have been compromised, who, when, and where said what and to whom. They don't know the extent to which their position is still tenable, if they're looking at early elections, or if they can continue to try to function under the present circumstances. So that's one aspect of it. Another aspect is, of course, that Poland is entering the election cycle domestically, it just had the elections to the European Parliament, and there's an upcoming election that's going to decide who will form the government. So you have a very polarized political scene where this kind of information becomes red meat for the opposition to challenge the government. And then the very clumsy move is, as what you've described, of trying to obtain the information and the actual sources, actual data from the Prost editorial board. And of course, this then ended up with the government backing out. Today, the Polish president spoke on the issue, trying to bring some calm to the situation. Because quite frankly, what worries me the most is not so much what politicians said in private over drinks and dinner, and were taped, unaware that they were being taped, and the whole event, of course, is illegal. This is not something that's permitted under the Polish law. But how that impacts the perception of Poland in the region at this critical moment, and how that impacts on the sense of the cohesion of the Polish state. And I think the citizenry is beginning to see this in that fashion. And that brings me again to the question I raised at the very beginning, Ian. Why now, and why these tapes have been so gradually leaked? This is almost like a drop-by-drop delivery process. Remember that Poland just had a very successful visit by Barack Obama, exceptionally well-received. I was there, actually, on the 4th of June when President Obama came to Poland. He said exactly what the Poles wanted to hear in terms of America's commitment to the security of Central Europe, NATO Article 5. Poland is in the process of, in effect, trying to develop a formula to increase U.S. and NATO military presence in Poland, which means a pretty radical shift in NATO strategy for Central and Northeastern Europe. So all of these things, in my view, are incredibly high stakes in high politics. And at the same time, all of a sudden, completely from the left field, you've got a series of these narratives coming out, in effect discrediting the government as a whole, individual ministers, and creating a sense of instability. And I would argue probably intentionally damaging Polish credibility as a partner, both vis-a-vis the United States and vis-a-vis other European allies. And that's why I keep saying, why now? I keep saying, why in this fashion, especially as these tapes have been accumulating over time. I want to add one more thing here. From what we know, reportedly the Prost editor said he received those recordings from a quote-unquote business person, a businessman. That tells me absolutely nothing. I mean, this could be some sort of a domestic endeavor. It could be an outside intelligence operation. It could be all sorts of factors. And until and unless the government gets to the bottom of it, and I think that's why you have this kind of nervousness that you see, we don't really know what the scope of this operation is and the long-term implications.
And of course, the government is saying that the tapes are coming from organized crime sources. But again, let me remind the audience that I'm speaking with Andrew Michter, who is a professor of international studies at Rhodes College and the author of several books on European security and transatlantic relations, including his most recent, The Limits of Alliance, the United States, NATO, and the EU in North and Central Europe. So the Amber Room, where these tapes were recorded, was, I think, a block or so from the Russian embassy. But I say that because the Polish press are speculating, as I think you are, that the most likely source for these tapes are the Russian intelligence service. And, of course, recently the Russian intelligence service released tapes of a very embarrassing conversation that the State Department official in charge of Europe, Victoria Nuland, had with the U.S. ambassador castigating the EU. So we've had recent examples of that kind of activity on the part of the Russians. And of course, Russia is led by a former intelligence officer who, this is his whole world, his whole universe here. But what solid evidence is there apart from the the obvious speculation that if you connect the dots, this is the most likely culprit and the most likely to benefit from it. But that's not how you're supposed to work in journalism. The way the real world works is that intentions determine outcomes. Outcomes don't determine intentions.
Yeah, that's true. And again, we're speculating about what the likely scenario here might be. And again, until the government actually has access to all the data and can review its procedures, remember that we're talking about senior government officials, the highest ministers in the land, the head of the National Bank, the Minister of the Interior. I mean, the Minister of the Interior, who's supposed to supervise all the security operations in the country, who himself is being taped. That was the first tape that was released. His conversation with the head of the National Bank. So this suggests to me possibly a level of carelessness on the side of the Polish government, or the level of sophistication on the part of the person who has done it, or most likely both. I worked in Poland recently for 2 years. I ran an office of the German Marshall Fund there from 2011 to 2013. And I know, I actually know those places that are being discussed. The restaurants that have been targeted are usually very favorite, frequented places for the Polish elite, and especially in that context, it would not be difficult just by reviewing the lists of reservations, attendees, looking at the patterns, to create the kind of a strategy to target these places and to record those particular individuals. There is a level of sophistication here that makes me that raises my eyebrows when I think about all of this. And the second thing is cui bono. You know, it is hitting at the ability of the Polish state to function effectively at the time when you have a profound international crisis on the periphery of Europe. If you think about what has been happening since about 2018, and this is another aspect we rarely talk about when we talk about the region, in 2008 at the Bucharest summit, some of the key NATO allies decided to block the idea of offering the membership action plan, which is a pathway to NATO membership, to Ukraine and to Georgia. Then you had the Russian-Georgian war that severed two provinces from Georgia in the process, and in effect ended any discussion of NATO enlargement to the east. And I'm bringing this to just put the larger context on what's going on in the region. In effect, Poland, the Baltic states, and then if you move south, also the rest of the so-called Visegrad 4 and Romania and going down, these are now frontier states in this increasingly tense standoff and confrontation between the newly resurgent near-imperial Russia of Vladimir Putin and NATO and Europe. And I think this raises the stakes, the stability, the cohesion, the ability of the Polish state to function. And Poland is the largest state in this region of NATO. That is something that plays an important role. Remember, Poland has also tried to move very forcefully to develop shale gas to, in effect, lower the dependence of Poland and the whole region on Russian energy. From Russian perspective, that is again something that's very dangerous to Moscow's ability to fund its government. In Moscow, Russia relies on long-term natural gas contracts for most of its revenue. I'm bringing these things up just to create a larger context, because we have focused so much on the scandal itself, and as you said in the very introduction to our conversation, some of these expressions that have been recorded and the terms that were used, they go even beyond of what Ms. Nuland said in her taped communication. So people tend to focus on this wonder what implication this will have. But I think there is a larger dimension of the overall security in the region and the stability of the region, and the consequences of having now a government in Poland that is, in effect, undermined by this very profound scandal.
And Andrew Michter, you brought up the shale gas issue in Poland. The former Danish Prime Minister, now NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen, recently said, just quoting him, that he has met allies who can report that Russia, as part of their sophisticated information and disinformation operations, engaged actively with so-called non-governmental organizations, environmental organizations working against shale gas to maintain European dependency on imported Russian gas. So he's charging that the Russian security services are in effect manipulating the environmental movements in Europe. This, of course, is an old KGB term called active measures, or translated as active measures. So what is the evidence so far that Russia is engaged in surreptitiously funding these NGOs that are against fracking?
And again, here's one of the issues that, in fact, I worked on. I've actually written on the shale gas revolution that's potentially underway in the region. We're operating in this very shadowy area. It's difficult to separate what seems to be a legitimate protest of local populations standing up to a Chevron drilling operation in Poland, demanding explanation on how the technology will impact. And the funding that goes into a larger-scale demonstration or lobbying in the European Parliament or elsewhere. Let me just put it in this way. If you look at a putative situation that Central Europe develops shale gas, that not just Poland, but Romania, Bulgaria, maybe Ukraine even, manages to produce commercial quantities of natural gas using unconventional methods, and when we talk about fracking. In effect, you're looking at the creation of spot market pricing for energy in Europe, and you're looking at a sudden change in the way Russia derives revenue, both in its relations to post-communist Central and Eastern Europe, but also to Germany and to other countries in Western Europe. I mean, countries in the northeastern belt, if you look at Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, you're looking at dependence from 100% to 80%. Poland is 60% dependent on Russian gas. And then, of course, the question of price. Russia needs long-term contracts that it locks in with the countries of Europe in order to fund its own government operations. And here, the price of gas, in the event that there would be all of a sudden additional source of supply coming in from the region, would be dramatically impacted. And the competitiveness of the region in terms of investment coming in from Western Europe to Central and Eastern Europe. And all of these factors are rolled into it. Suffice it to say, at the height of the crisis in Ukraine, Russia negotiated not a very advantageous, but nonetheless a long-term 30-year deal with China to supply China with natural gas. And there are other projects, infrastructure and otherwise, that are built around it, simply, in my view, to find alternatives and to send a message that in the event relations with Europe continue to deteriorate, it has other markets and other ways to raise revenue. To sum this up, I would argue we're looking at a major surge of geostrategic competition in this part of the world. And the Polish crisis that you see today, of course, we don't know who actually set up the whole bugging operation, who delivered the tapes and whatnot. But the consequences of this, whether this is a Russian intelligence operation or something that has been generated internally with external support or not, this is playing into this larger shifting picture of security in North and Central Europe. And in effect, the momentum that you had from the entire post-Cold War period, this kind of democratic enlargement from the West to the East, and we're even talking about bringing Ukraine. Some of us even talked about possibly Russia integrating eventually with this open system. That has been stopped. The momentum has shifted. You now have a new fault line that's emerged and is beginning to consolidate ever more in Eastern Europe. And countries like Poland, the country we're talking about today, are now frontier states. And I think the question is the extent to which they will be able to withstand the Russian pressure and the extent to which NATO will come up with a coherent response to what's going on.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Andrew Michter.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Michter, who's a professor of international studies at Rhodes College and the author of several books on European security and transatlantic relations, including his most recent, The Limits of Alliance, the United States, NATO, and the EU in North and Central Europe. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how much Pope Francis has put a target on his back by excommunicating the mafia.
Cammina passo di regole sociali, su conosciuto io su internazionali, battu la strada in cerca di novità, su sentinella sgarrista d'umiltà. Parlo con voi, bello saggio compagno, per chi portati si cinque punti d'oro, cubi portavo a punta società, e vi insegnavo sta legge d'umiltà.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Vallely, who is a writer and consultant on religion, business ethics, and international development, and a visiting professor in public ethics and media at the University of Chester. He is a senior research fellow at the Brooks World Poverty Institute at the University of Manchester and director of The Tablet and a columnist for The Church Times. His latest book is Pope Francis, Untying the Knots. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Vallely.
Hello.
And just a few days ago, the Pope went down to Calabria and took on one of the world's most vicious organized crime families, or organizations, I should say. Apparently, back in January, a three-year-old boy was killed along with his grandfather in a car that was riddled with bullets and then set on fire. And this apparently shocked a lot of people. And the Pope went down there to comfort the family of the three-year-old boy. But in doing so, he basically took on the mob and said, quoting the Pope Francis, "Those who go down the evil path, as the mafioso do, are not in communion with God. They are excommunicated." So what kind of an effect do you think that would have on this criminal organization whose annual revenues are something like $75 billion?
It will have a very dramatic effect because popes have in the past made remarks about the mafia. Pope John Paul II blasted the Sicilian mafia in 1993. But no pope has ever done what this pope has done, which is to use the word excommunication with regard to the mafia. And the Calabrian mafia, known as the 'Ndrangheta, are a particularly peculiar mafia. They're very religious. They like to fund church organizations, and when the church has processions, they like them to stop outside their own homes to acknowledge the fact that it's all been paid for by the mafia. And they go to church. So they will take this as a very direct affront.
So a lot of people in Rome apparently were quite concerned. One, there are some concerns about the Pope's health, even though he seems very vigorous. Apparently, he's been ordered to rest. Do you have any information that he may have health problems? Because that he certainly had passed all of the tests recently.
Well, I mean, he's a man who's got part of one of his lungs missing. He's put on a bit of weight since he became Pope, and he's been working round the clock 7 days a week. So it's taken its toll on him, and he's had a few colds and slight fevers. The Vatican insists that it's nothing serious, but he's just decided to slow down a little, which clearly he would need to do, and some of his senior cardinals have advised him to do that. But it's always very difficult with the Vatican, because in the past they've issued statements to say there's nothing wrong with the Pope, and then the next day he dies. So you can't always rely on what the Vatican says in this. But my hunch is that he's just
exhausted could, because he's been working too hard. And I don't think it is a serious issue at this point.
So in terms of what the Pope did recently by cleaning up the Vatican Bank and replaced the Vatican Financial Watchdog Board, the entire board, and replaced them with a lot of international figures, one of whom is a former national security advisor to President George W. Bush. So tell me, is there a connection here in terms of, it's often been rumored that the mafia launders all, you know, obviously they launder their money all over the place, but that the mafia also launders money through the Vatican Bank. So is there any sense here that in excommunicating the mafia, the Pope is endangering himself and taking on, you know, a real war against some really bad people?
Well, he may be endangering himself. He doesn't seem to be bothered about that. I mean, he's just got rid of his Pope mobile, he's announced. And when he was in Israel and Palestine, he refused to ride around in an armored car, a bulletproof car. So he seems to be a man who I mean, he's actually said to one journalist, you know, at my age, I don't think you need to worry about dying too much. So I think he's got a fairly gutsy attitude to this. Having said that, I don't think that the cleaning up of the Vatican Bank is linked to the mafia at all. The Vatican Bank is not a huge operation in terms of the size of banks. And it's not thought that that there was enough money going through it, about $5 billion US dollars a year, I think. Not enough money going through to represent large scale money laundering on the scale that that you would associate with the mafia. What the Vatican Bank has been used for nefariously is Italians use it to funnel money through tax dodges. So there've been a lot of there's been a lot of bad behavior inside the Vatican Bank, but I don't think it's connected with the mafia.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Valelli, who is a writer and consultant on religion, business, ethics, and international development, and a visiting professor in public ethics and media at the University of Chester. He is also a senior research fellow at the Brooks World Poverty Institute at the University of Manchester and director of The Tablet, and a columnist for the Church Times. His latest book is Pope Francis, Untying the Knots. Well, if the Vatican Bank only circulates $5 billion a year, the organization that the Pope went after down in Calabria, their operations stretch across the globe to Australia and Germany. Their annual revenues are in the range of $75 billion, which is around 3.5%. of Italy's GDP.
So they're linked to the Colombian cocaine trade and also the Mexican cocaine trade.
So they're the gateway of a lot of drugs into Europe, then, I take it.
Yes, although apparently they bring the drugs through Africa now.
I see, but the market's in Europe.
The market is in Europe. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we've had a history of one of the earlier popes only lasting weeks or so, and there are all kinds of conspiracy theories about that. How much does the Pope have to watch his back, do you think?
Well, his friends, when I was researching the biography, I talked to a lot of his friends in Argentina, people he still rings up every week. And they've said, that, you know, one of them said to him, "Remember, Jorge, the Borgias still live in the Vatican," and he laughed. But they believe that one of the reasons he's gone to live in the Casa Santa Marta, the Vatican hostel, rather than living in the Apostolic Palace, is that he's mixing with ordinary people. He eats food from the canteen, and there's not much chance of poisoning him. Now, I think this is all rather alarmist, and I don't think that John Paul I was murdered. But it's a measure of the level of concern that people have for the Pope that they say these things.
And in terms of your biography of the Pope, Pope Francis, Untying the Knots, you went to Argentina, and the very people that you just mentioned, who we talked to regularly on the phone, the Pope's friends from back then, you met with them. At the time, there were some stories suggesting that somehow he wasn't sufficiently zealous in going after the military death squads. I think one priest had made those accusations. But on the other hand, a lot of people came to his defense and saying he did more than what he had to do. And he did quite a lot of behind the scenes to, you know, stand up to this horrendous fratricide that went on, some of the most horrific acts since the Nazis, in effect. So tell me, what is the real story there in terms of, from what you've learned about what the Pope did in terms of standing up to the generals in the dirty war?
Well, he was the leader of the Jesuits then. He wasn't a major figure in the church. He wasn't a bishop or an Argentinian church leader. He was the leader of one particular order. And he didn't speak out against the military dictatorship. Those bishops who did, some of them ended up having mysterious car accidents and so forth. So he certainly is guilty, as it were, of silence and of not speaking out. On the other hand, he did work behind the scenes to smuggle a lot of people who were being pursued by the military out of the country, and he even gave his own documents and clothing to one man to smuggle him out. So he's got a mixed record on that. The main accusation made against him was that he had betrayed two of his own Jesuits to the military, men that he was engaged in a dispute with. And I examine in the book, I examine in great detail all of these claims and counterclaims, and I come to the conclusion that he didn't betray these men, but that he was reckless in his dispute with them, and that gave out signals to the military that these men were not bona fide and could be picked up. So, and that's something that all the evidence is. The Pope regretted and has been, as it were, atoning for the rest of his life.
But in terms of his political outlooks, as much as you can divine them, what is your understanding? Obviously, Cardinal Ratzinger was an extremely conservative, his predecessor, and he's still around, by the way, and it's a very strange thing that nobody's able to figure out, or nobody's made any definitive statement about of why he left the Vatican and the papacy. And the Polish Pope prior to him, John Paul, was obviously very conservative, went after the liberation theology people with a vengeance, ended up going down to Chile to stand beside Pinochet and dignify that horrible mass murderer whose activities are similar to what happened in Argentina in the Dirty War. So what's your sense of what the Pope's politics are?
His politics are, he grew up in a Peronist background, and the Peronists were a curious mixture of an alliance between the church, the military, and the trade unions against the kind of business class. So rather an odd notion in terms of the US or European politics. It doesn't really fit Peronism. But he started out as quite an authoritarian and conservative character, but he had an amazing transformation at the age of 50 when he was he's referred to it since as an inner spiritual crisis when he was in exile in Cordoba, which is the second city of Argentina, and from then on he became a different kind of person, and his leadership style changed, and he became much more aligned with the poor. He became known as the Bishop of the Slums when he was made a bishop, spent all his time with poor people, and the liberation theology, which he'd been very much against when he was a younger man and the leader of the Jesuits, he came to value and to rejuvenate, and he's embraced it to such an extent that the father of liberation theology, Gustavo Gutierrez, has been welcomed into the Vatican, and there's been a kind of rapprochement between liberation theology and the Vatican under Francis. So he's a man who's been on a political journey. In terms of his churchmanship, I think he's still quite conservative in terms of his doctrine, but although he's not a revolutionary in terms of his politics, he's certainly a revolutionary in terms of his style, and he wants to turn the church upside down and turn the Vatican from being the master of the church into the servant of the church and change the whole way that the Catholic Church makes decisions around the world.
Well, I think the fact that he did so much pastoral work, that he was actually out there toiling in the fields of our Lord, as they say, and as you mentioned, ministering to the poor. In contrast, the Polish Pope didn't do much pastoral work, and certainly Pope Francis's predecessor, Cardinal Ratzinger, only did 1 year of pastoral work and hated it. Most of these previous popes have come out of the Vatican political machinery as opposed to being priests out there in touch with the real people.
Well, I mean, all popes have got different strengths and different weaknesses. And John Paul II was a bit of a rock star pope. He captured the imagination of the world. He'd worked with Solidarity and helped bring about the fall of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall, all down to him. So, I mean, he had huge strengths. And is religiously, yes, he was more conservative, and he became more conservative as he got older. Cardinal Ratzinger was a much less conservative pope than people had expected, because he'd been a quite a fiercely conservative figure when he was in charge of being the watchdog of the Roman Church's doctrine. But he showed some kind of pastoral qualities, or not pastoral, some gentler qualities when he was doing his visits around the world. And Francis, by contrast, has been on the streets. I mean, one of the people I spoke to in one of the slums in Argentina said to me, he brings the mud of the slums with him into the Vatican on his boots. So you know, Francis has got different strengths entirely, and his contact with ordinary people is one of those. And he's a man who puts pastoral care of individuals above doctrinal matters. He said that the church has been too obsessed with some of these issues in the past, what in the States you call the hot-button issues. He's got no patience with that. He doesn't disclose his hand as to what he thinks about them, but he says there are more important things to talk about, and he wants the church to be a church of the poor for the poor, and he wants this kind of audacious humility and poverty to be its watchword.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Paul Vallelli, and I guess we can only hope that the Pope, both that his health is good and that he can dodge a bullet, which is surely coming his way when you take on the mafia. I thank you again.
Thank you. Good night.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Vallelli, who's in the United Kingdom. He is a writer and consultant on religion, business ethics, and international development, and a visiting professor in public ethics and media at the University of Chester. He is a senior research fellow at the Brooks World Poverty Institute at the University of Manchester and director of The Tablet and a columnist for The Church Times. His latest book is Pope Francis, Untying the Knots. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm